From the Sky News Centre at 5, the Prime Minister and Labour leader have visited the West Yorkshire town where an MP was killed yesterday. Tim Jones reports.
David Cameron joined Jeremy Corbyn in laying flowers and paying tribute to Joe Cox in Birstall.
Someone who epitomised the fact that politics is about serving others.
The Labour leader also announced Parliament would be recalled on Monday so MPs can pay tribute to the mother of two who were shot and stabbed.
She was taken from us in an act of hatred. It's an attack on democracy.
The Conservatives, Lib Dems and UKIP have confirmed they won't be contesting Joe's seat in a by-election. Later, another vigil will be held for her in Westminster.
Russia's athletic stars won't be representing their country at the Rio Olympics. Governing body, the IAAF, has upheld a ban handed out for widespread state-sponsored doping. Russia says it'll appeal to the International Olympic Committee. Police investigating the murder of a Suffolk man and the disappearance of his wife have arrested a man in Luxembourg. 42-year-old Ali Quasimaj is suspected of murdering 75-year-old Peter Stewart, whose body was found close to his Weybread home. Detective Chief Superintendent Simon Parks from Suffolk Police says the search for Mr. Stewart's wife continues.
We're still very much looking for Sylvia. So although I now have no expectation of finding Sylvia alive, it is still the case that we maintain our search and we maintain the officers who are currently looking to try and locate her.
A process to extradite the suspect has now begun. Medical aid charity Doctors Without Borders says it'll no longer accept funding from the European Union. It says it's because of the EU's shameful and damaging migration policies. That's the latest. I'm Claire Gregory.
Apologies for the announcement there, which seems, I think, to be earlier this morning. But it's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's weekly politics show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. Well, it's just old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. He didn't get really quite a fair crack of the whip last week. We're going to give him a lot more today. After the 6 o'clock news, killings in Orlando and in West Yorkshire in Batley last weekend also, the secret rulers of the NATO countries got together with the apex of the German government to plan our future as their serfs. So, who was there? And we hear the latest research from German writers and researchers on the origins of the Bilderberg and hear from the horse's mouth how they tried to intimidate German political scientists into leaving them alone. We even go back to the office of one of Germany's first two Bilderberg members in the 1950s and hear who came in to invite Rudolf Müller along to May 1954 to the very first ever Bilderberg meeting. These are the most powerful political lobby and very secret too, with politicians and media involved in the NATO countries. Well, I was at the Bilderberg conference last week in Dresden, Germany, and Dresden's also home to the popular German Pegida nationalist anti-refugee movement, which holds a demonstration every Monday in the city. I got an exclusive interview with Pegida's leader, Lutz Bachmann. Plus, it's Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius, mainly dry this weekend, highs of 18, sunnier on Saturday, cloudier though on Sunday. A few showers throughout the weekend, so forget the shopping this weekend if you possibly can, and go out on Saturday and Sunday, but mainly Saturday. Next week, highs of 22, mainly dry with sunny spells and scattered showers. Next weekend, that's the 25th and the 26th of June, highs of 22 Celsius and sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Hi, Martin. Welcome to The Politics Show.
Hi, Tony.
Now, I think because you're a Remainer and I'm a Brexiter, it probably is a good idea for us to have a little bit of a battle this week, you know, sort of you putting your point of view and me putting mine. The country hasn't had a chance to vote on this since the 1970s. We went into the EEC under the Edward Heath Conservative government in 1973, I believe, and then it was 2 years before we ever had a vote to say whether we wanted to endorse that decision. Why did it take those extra 2 years, and why wasn't there a referendum back in the 1970s?
Well, if you remember the history, Britain had tried to join the EU several times.
Sorry, the EEC.
The EEC, sorry. A bit of an anachronism there. Basically, at that stage of the game, the French in particular were very unhappy about having Britain in the European Economic Community, because they saw it as a mechanism for building. Two main goals of the French civil service were to basically tie Germany into a situation in relationship with France where they could never go to war again. So, in other words, they were going to basically merge the political elites in both countries. And also, the French saw it as a means of establishing an independent voice for Europe away from the Anglo-Saxons and obviously away from the Russians. So the British were very unwelcome, particularly to General de Gaulle. So the Bilderberg Group and others, including the CIA and others, were pushing for Britain to be included. The French were very hostile to the Britain being included, but ultimately the Americans are the real puppet masters of everything, and they pushed the British to keep asking to join, and they pushed the French, and even less so the Germans, to accept British membership. So it was all very much kind of spatched together. And of course, Edward Heath, who had been a colonel in World War II, was a Bilderberger and very, very keen on the EU. You know, he never made any secret of it. He saw it as an idealistic institution which would, prevent war in Europe, etc. But of course, from the US point of view, they didn't want a European Union that was run by France with Britain outside of it. They wanted Britain in there to undermine any kind of independent policy in the EU. And Britain in the EU has certainly played that role.
Now, back in the 1970s, we had Dave Barbie in here a few months ago talking about Britain's technology that we had in the 70s and that was then given up. I mean, for example, there was a rocket, almost like the American space program, not quite up to their size and standard. Obviously, they weren't going to the moon, but there was certainly the ability to put satellites into space, that sort of thing, launch our own ballistic missiles if we wanted to. But basically, that went out the window, and then we started having to buy everything from the US.
Yes, and that's the US telling everybody what to do. And one of the things that's hardly been mentioned in the Brexit debate is I would like to ask all Brexiters whether they are in favour or against the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. And I'm afraid lots of Tory MPs are in favour of the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, even though they want to leave the EU. So they want to leave the EU. The Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership will then be negotiated between the EU and the Americans, and we will then join that.
Well, we may not join it, actually.
Well, we may not, but we need to. I would ask, I want to hear from all Brexiters what's their position on TTIP.
TTIP is another one of those big supernatural bodies, a bit like the World Trade Organization. Mm-hmm. And it does seem as if there's a real fad and lots of money behind this attempt to have these gigantic, in a way, in parallel with the US military commands, with these big trading blocks like NAFTA in the United States and South America, and also in Africa too, big trading blocks in Africa and AFRICOM. Do you think that's the way the world is just naturally going that way to big intercontinental organisations?
Well, it's funny you should mention the World Trade Organization, because the way this stuff works is that the World Trade Organization is supposedly independent above all trading blocks. It's supposed to be, the referee. But in practice, if it doesn't do what the US wants, then they start setting up other things to do the same job that the World Trade Organization can no longer do for them. So trade negotiations are the most important thing that go on, and they're highly technical, and so they're conducted in secret by teams of corporate lawyers. And then they are presented to the people as, oh, this is a brilliant idea, why don't we all go down this road? But I think it's very bizarre that people who want to leave the European Union, many of them on the right wing of the Tory party, are also in favour of the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which means that all the rules in Britain will be set from Brussels via the United States of America.
Well, good to be out of it then, I would say.
Well, anyway. But what Brexit may do if it happens, and it looks increasingly as if it might, is it may sabotage the transatlantic trade and investment partnership, but it won't be the only thing it sabotages.
Okay. Also, I mean, let's move away from the referendum discussion, because we skipped a Prime Minister's question, so I had a little listen through that earlier on today, and picked out a couple of questions from a fortnight ago, and one of them, I mean, because we followed this prevent strategy, haven't we? Mm-hmm. Really over the last, I think it was 2011 it was first brought in, so that's 5 years or so it's been going. It's had a new boost from this new government elected last year, all steered through by David Cameron as Prime Minister both times in both governments. But there are some serious problems with it, aren't there? And I know we heard from, I think it was one of the Lib Dems on the City Council here on this show, that Bristol simply did not accept the original version of Prevent and demanded some changes were made before it was implemented here in the city.
Well, that's right. I mean, there is what you might call the mainstream criticism of Prevent, that it's largely worthless, it alienates the Muslim community, and it doesn't actually achieve its stated goals. But underlying all of this, of course, is its fundamental misapprehension of what Islamic terrorism is. It's seen as self-radicalisation on the internet, whereas in actual fact, it's a creation of the Western intelligence services, particularly MI6, I mean, CIA, Mossad.
This whole idea of radicalisation, well, one would expect if you've got any kind of tyranny, people will be getting radical anyway.
Well, I mean, there's the mainstream left wing sees it in this way. They say, well, if you're going to kill a million Iraqis, you're bound to create some blowback. But I don't see it in that way. I think an awful lot of these terrorist attacks are actually being orchestrated. The prevent strategy is part of the police state strategy, which is what this is all really about, to control the population's way of thinking and to keep tabs on them.
It's a bit like sort of snitching on your neighbours, that kind of thing. That's very much encouraged by prevent.
It is, and of course it's missing the point, because the evidence is piling up that most of the, and in Syria it's been absolutely obvious that many of the jihadis who fought in Syria and then come back and supposedly carried out these attacks have been in contact with the intelligence services all the way. They were encouraged to go to Syria. So there was a trial at the Old Bailey of a Swede whose name I've forgotten now that collapsed about 6 months ago. He'd been arrested by West Midlands police, he was planning to go to Syria, and his defence lawyers argued yes, but he was going to fight for a group that MI6 are arming and training. And at that point, the case was dropped and he was released. That's why we have trials at the Old Bailey instead of the government just deciding who is and who isn't a terrorist, because what that trial showed was that MI6 are definitely involved in arming and training jihadi terrorists inside Syria. So when those same terrorists come back and attack us, is that an accident or is that part of the plan?
Fiona Bruce!
Next week, the annual National Parliamentary Prayer Breakfast will take place here in Westminster Hall, when 600 community and faith leaders and over 100 MPs will gather. Yet also this week we hear of a Christian union being banned from holding prayer and Bible study meetings, purportedly on the grounds of the government's anti-terrorism prevent strategy. Does the Prime Minister agree that such action was never the purpose of a strategy intended to address terrorism and extremism?
Prime Minister!
Of course, what my honourable friend says is right. I'm very sorry, I'm not going to be able to attend the prayer breakfast, because I know it is it's a very good event and it brings a lot of people together and means a lot to Christians around our country. The point she makes about the prevent duty being misused, I haven't heard of that exact example, but I mean, it's clearly ludicrous, and people do need to exercise some common sense in making these judgments, because it's quite clear that's not what was intended.
Well, as the Prime Minister, they're talking about common sense, Martin, but people are told that, well, you know, you should just make sure you tell the authorities and don't tell the person themselves. Isn't the best thing to do if you're, I mean, if you suspect someone is being radicalised or whatever, but it's a thin line, isn't it, between whether you go to the authorities or whether you approach the person directly?
Well, it's certainly a problem for people like teachers, for example, who may have children in their class who've got funny ideas or whatever. Should they be reporting to the authorities, or should they be engaging with those ideas to try and talk some sense?
I mean, saying things like they don't trust the mainstream media, apparently that can be flaggable as on the prevent strategy and reportable to the police.
Well, indeed, what I would argue is if you have any evidence of terroristic activity, you should approach your local police at the lowest possible level, because I'm afraid the intelligence services are not to be trusted. They are suspects, quite frankly, and we need to develop a mechanism, a standard operating procedure for dealing with this. And of course in Bristol that worked pretty well when the local Muslim community here identified a potential bomber who was not actually originally a Muslim but a convert and a loner, self-radicalised on the internet supposedly, although of course the question is, what was he watching on the internet? Who was he in contact with? And of course we know that the jihadis fighting in Syria have been recruited all over the world by Western intelligence services, sent to Turkey for training by our own special forces, and then infiltrated into Syria. And then some of them turn up and carry out attacks in Blighty.
You could say that the Bristol one is just one example, but it's not, is it? Because at Finsbury Park Mosque, the mosque leaders there reported the Al-Majarun crew.
Yeah.
Harun Aswat.
Yeah.
And Abu Hamza, that's the pair. Yeah. They reported them to the Metropolitan Police, who said, just leave them where they are. We'll keep a very close eye on them. Let's leave them. And then, of course, 2 years later, we had the 7/7 bomb attacks, where Harun Aswat himself was personally implicated in that, as the mastermind who'd been speaking to the 7/7 bombers just beforehand. So what does that tell us about what we should do in these sorts of circumstances?
Well,
it looks as if the authorities in some cases have actually been complicit with the terrorists.
They have indeed. Abdul Hakim Belhaj, who is suing the British government for extraditing him to Libya to be tortured. He was in prison in Libya, having been tortured, having been delivered to Libya by the British. But when he escaped from prison, the British put pressure on Gaddafi to release what they call political prisoners, and Belhaj was one of those. So he was released. He then immediately started to form his militia, the Islamic Fighting Group of Libya, and these people were then, with SAS training and RAF support, overthrew Gaddafi. But his relationship with our intelligence services is intimate, going back 30, 40 years.
Okay, back to last week's Prime Minister's questions. And one of the things that struck me about this is the various rumours I've been getting. I mean, I would say, you have to say rumours, but from pretty good sources, that David Cameron is going to announce that he'll be stepping down after this referendum. And that was the implication of one of the questions asked last week as well.
Stephen Gethin!
Yeah.
As he reaches the end of his time in office... Yeah. President Obama reflected. His worst mistake was the catastrophe in Libya. What's the Prime Minister's worst mistake in his time in office?
Prime Minister!
The time to reflect on your mistakes is clearly when you're close to the end of your time in office, so that doesn't apply.
Well, I mean, obviously, Cameron is bluffing it out, but we all know, because he said that he's not going to be leading the Conservative Party into the next general election in 2020. Pretty much the sort of thing that Tony Blair was forced to say by Gordon Brown. So I think that it's quite likely that if Brexit goes through, his position will become untenable. And if it doesn't go through, those who have been frustrated will be gunning for him, so his position is untenable.
I mean, what about this idea, though, that you can elect somebody as Prime Minister for one term, and then they realise that they're going to be very unpopular, they're doing unpopular things, they're not doing what they said they'd do in their manifesto, etc., cheating the public, some would say, and so that you have to kind of swap the Prime Minister halfway through a term because they're kind of tainted goods, a soiled brand.
Well, in actual fact, this whole, you know, the silly act that the Tories have passed, the Permanent Parliament Act, that, you know, you've got a 5-year parliament. Now, it's arguable whether that is constitutional. But if you get to a situation where the Tory party doesn't want Cameron to lead them, and they can't agree on who will follow on, and they haven't got a majority to form, to get legislation through the House of Commons, I can't see how a government like that can go on for 5 years.
I mean, there's been an immense amount of criticism of Cameron for not doing proper head-to-head debates on this referendum, just doing them with journalists, etc. And, you know, that's surely an indication that he's not got the staying power. He doesn't intend to continue.
Well, I mean, don't forget that somebody like Cameron is, frankly, a hobby politician. He's a wealthy guy.
He's been put in there to do
a certain kind of a job. And in actual fact, he's already demob happy. Samantha Cameron wants to walk away and, you know, they'll earn some serious money like politicians do.
Aren't I right?
And have a much more comfy lifestyle than the one they've got.
Aren't I right in saying that she's got her eyes on a nice pad down in the Maldives in the Indian Ocean?
I understand she has. Now, of course, we're getting inside information that he may be going to get a payoff from his involvement in 1991 in going to South Africa to talk about what was going to happen to South Africa's nuclear weapons. He, David Kelly, and Sir Kenneth Warren, who's a big fundraiser for the Tory party, went down there to talk with Magnus Malan, who was then the defence minister, about what was going to happen to South Africa's nuclear weapons. Three of them were bought by the British government to be dismantled, but they were bought via a third party, Astra Holdings, which was controlled by an ex-MI6 officer called Stephen Cox.
Martin, I know we have talked about this before, but there is a major problem with this story in that surely, I mean, there's no reason why that should be a reason for Cameron to have to resign now. I mean, this is back in 1989, I think. This
no,
trip.
But if all the evidence about it is there on file and has not come out, he can be threatened and be told, yes, if you do not do what we want you to do, this will come out.
It's like in MI5's yeah. Black Book or whatever.
Yeah,
they're sitting there waiting.
It's the game they play called Peccadillos, where you just say, who had sex with an underage boy in 1973? Who around this table? Come on.
That's amazing, isn't it? A lot of this stuff, it does seem that we've got a whole political class in Britain, or maybe we've had this for decades, that they're only there because they're easily blackmailable.
Well, don't forget that those who want to blackmail them, the evil ones, whoever they are put a lot of effort into doing it. And they don't allow anybody to get into any position of authority that isn't blackmailable.
Okay,
that's the whole point.
Here's a question. Who do you think? Is there anyone you could name or organisation that might be doing that job, blackmailing them?
Well, I think there is a criminal oligarchy working through the intelligence services and the banking system.
Certainly, that's
the way. We call them MI6, but they're just fact-agents.
That's the way it looked at Bilderberg, for certain. But what about MI5? I mean,
you've got all these different organisations out there. You've got lots of what about Blackwater? What about all these private security companies staffed with people trained by the taxpayer?
Okay. Speculation fest over, because Jon Snow interviewed David Cameron this week, and I've got clips from a couple of the questions he asked. So first of all, obviously, about Brexit.
In my political lifetime, I've never argued for out.
No, but that's all lots of nevers, but you actually talked about the promised land in Europe. You don't have a passion for Europe. You've never expressed a passion. And that's, in a sense, why this competition, this campaign is in trouble.
I don't accept that. I'm not a utopian dreamer. I believe in the United Kingdom and in Britain and in our future. But I think we are better off, safer and stronger as part of a European Union. But my arguments, I accept. I'm a practical person. My arguments are mostly practical about the strength of our economy, about the safety of our people, about the strength of our country. I think there are bits of idealism within me. I think that, when I look at the fact that we sit around this table and talk with each other and Europe has found a way to avoid conflict, that does make me proud.
That's jolly difficult in the face of Albion and people talking about the old days, the good old days when Britain was great. We want to put the great back into Britain. And all you're saying is, well, I think we'd be a bit better in Europe. It's a bit safer.
I think I'm making a stronger argument than that. As I was saying today, I think, Churchill stood alone in May 1940 and decided to fight on, but he didn't want to be alone. Mm. He wanted to be fighting with others in Europe. He was standing up for European democracy and freedom and the rule of law, and I think we should stand up for that again today.
It's almost implying Churchill wanted a kind of EU back before the war, and he's saying, that maybe that would have stopped the Second World War.
Well, Churchill was quite clear that he wanted a European Union. He even said that Britain would join such a European Union. Did you know that in 1940, when the French Vichy government was trying to decide which way to jump, he said, well, let's just merge France and Britain into one country. We will offer you that as an incentive for you to stand up to fight on against the Germans.
But then,
and of course in those
yeah.
days, that's the sort of thing people were prepared to do.
But then, of course, he was roundly criticised by many people during the war, although he was the wartime leader. And, of course, the public gave their verdict in 1945 and kicked him out, didn't they?
They did. But I think, in actual fact, the idea that the Tory party has always been absolutely hostile to the European Union is simply wrong. Churchill, I mean, Churchill was working with the Americans, and the Americans wanted a European Union. So, you know, his wife was American. And you've got to realise that at the elite level, there's been a lot, you know, this has never been settled properly. But the real power isn't at the European Commission. The European Commission is an unelected quango, but it's nothing like the Pentagon, okay. Wall Street.
You reckon Wall Street and the Pentagon decide what goes on at the in Brussels?
Absolutely. Why are we going to war with Russia against the international interests of Germany?
What about all these big multinationals that sit on the round table of industrialists?
Well, where are those multinationals headquartered, Tony?
Some are in Europe and some are in the United States. Actually, mostly in Germany and the US.
Yeah, but I mean, the fact is we've got sanctions on Russia, which is absolutely against the interests of the West Europeans.
Yes, Germans were the Germans absolutely roundly recognising that.
Completely bonkers
there.
From their point. You've got three former chancellors saying this is nuts, why are we doing this? But they're doing it anyway because they're an occupied country. In actual fact, the German constitution has a piece in it that says that at any time the Americans can abrogate the whole constitution. It's a gift from the Anglo-Americans, and they can take it away if they don't like it.
The next topic that Jon Snow brought up with the Prime Minister David Cameron was that of election expenses.
Can I just ask you then about election expenses, yeah. Which is something that we've worked out very extensively. Why have you been prepared to spend money on a QC to try and stop police investigating what we have revealed?
Well, we haven't been doing that. What we're doing is we are cooperating with the
QC in the Thanet South constituency, in the court, actually asking the judge to stop the investigation.
Well, there's a year-long process of investigating these things.
But you didn't want that year. You went to court to ask the court not to allow the police an extension to go on investigating these abuses.
That's right. As I said, there had been a year, and it's perfectly legitimate to argue, well, that's enough time to look at it. But look, I'm very happy for the Electoral Commission to examine all of this.
Well, why get a QC to stop it, then?
Well, that was in one particular seat. But I'm very happy that they've got the time now, and they've got all the paperwork to examine this. But I think...
Well, they have got the paperwork, but, Prime Minister, with respect, the Electoral Commission had to go to court to wring the papers out of you.
They didn't have to go to court.
They did.
That's not
you,
right.
You were
that
three
is,
days overdue, and they had to go to court.
We had told them when the papers were going to be delivered, and so in our view, that was unnecessary.
That is not their view.
Well, that is not my view.
Will you, as Prime Minister, move this thing speedily through so that it can be resolved as quickly as possible? Because at the moment, your own majority, if any of this is proved, is in serious danger.
Well, what we're doing is answering the questions of the Electoral Commission. As I say, I think, look, it's a Channel 4 investigation, and I know you're proud of the work that you've done. We're very happy. We're answering all the questions. I think you're making quite a large mountain out of what I think is a relatively straightforward...
So you disagree with the judge,
then? No, I think it's a relatively straightforward set of questions that we have to answer. I'm very confident we're going to answer all of them and put this issue comfortably away.
Well, I seem to remember this is the same Prime Minister who was quite happy to see a young fella sent down for 2 years for stealing a bottle of water during the 2011 disturbances. But he doesn't believe in the rule of law for his own party, does he?
Now, what's the implication of all this, though, Martin? Do you think that this will run this, or is it going to be kicked into the long grass? One is, maybe once upon a time the British judicial system was well trusted, but nowadays one does wonder if the political influence in the judiciary will be brought to bear here, and quite clearly there's very strong evidence that the Conservatives in these, I think it's a 15, 20 constituencies now, overspent their expenses limit and fraudulently declared it, so that could mean all those there have to be by-elections.
Well, you'd think so, wouldn't you? Probably not, because as you say, they've got enough clout to prevent that. But what they haven't got the clout to prevent is people like us talking about it. And every time it comes to an election, we'll say, well, what did happen about those expenses? And so it's not going to go away, not in this day and age. It'll dog them around like an albatross. And that's the only thing you can do. If they can't be punished, you can make sure that they're punished in the court of public opinion.
Another thing this week was the Home Affairs Select Committee interviewing Labour's former London Mayor Ken Livingstone about his alleged anti-Semitism. And this is about 2 or 3 minutes, but let's have a listen to the report on that from the BBC Radio 4 in their Today in Parliament.
The former Mayor of London, Ken Livingstone, has refused to apologise for the comments about Hitler and Zionism that led to his suspension from the Labour Party. The Home Affairs Committee is carrying out an inquiry into anti-Semitism. When Mr. Livingstone appeared before the MPs, the Labour chair of the committee, Keith Vaz, asked him if he wanted to apologise.
If I had said that Hitler was a Zionist, I would apologise for that, because it's rubbish. What I said was, and you can still access this on the BBC website, that when Hitler won his election in 1932, his policy was that the Jews should be moved to Israel. He was supporting Zionism. He wanted all the 500,000 German Jews out. At that stage, his view was to move them out. By the autumn of 1933, he had negotiated a deal with the German Zionist organisation that did lead to 66,000 German Jews being moved to what is now Israel. Had the Zionists not negotiated that deal, those 66,000 Jews would have died in the gas chamber.
Indeed.
During the exchanges, Ken Livingstone apologised if his remarks had caused offence, but insisted what he'd said was true.
If I could go back in time and avoid referring to Hitler and Zionism in the Vanessa Phelps interview, I would, because
you would or you wouldn't?
I would go back and remove it, because it allowed, all the anti-Jeremy people in the Labour Party to start whipping up this as an even bigger issue.
Mr. Livingstone was suspended from the Labour Party in April. He told the committee he'd enjoyed a lot of public support and had the backing of many Jewish people.
I couldn't move, this last few months, I can't get down the street without people stopping me and saying, we know what you said is true, don't give in. Of course, a lot of Jewish people in the community are offended because they've been told a lie. They've been told that I was a Nazi apologist. What appalls me is that a handful of Labour MPs used this issue, deliberately lied about what I'd said, and smeared me because they wished to undermine the leader of the Labour Party. It's that simple. And, they should be the ones being suspended.
Later, during angry exchanges, the Labour MP Chakramuna told Mr. Livingstone, you're not a historian, you're a politician.
And by needlessly and repeatedly offending Jewish people in this way, you not only betray our Labour values, but you betray your legacy as mayor, because all you're now going to be remembered for is becoming a pin-up for the kind of prejudice that our party was built to fight against. That is a huge shame, and it's an embarrassment. And you know what? I would get trolled incessantly after this exchange.
Mr. Miller, please put your question. This is not an opportunity to make statements. What is your question? Is there a question for Mr. Livingstone?
I'm just making a comment since he won't answer any of my questions.
All I'd say is, if you look back, many of the things I've said have been controversial. When I defended lesbian and gay rights in 1981, we were denounced. When we said we needed to negotiate with the IRA, we were denounced. The simple fact is, show me what I got wrong in those times. I was just prepared to challenge the bigotry of the day, and I'm prepared to challenge bigotry today.
I'm challenging your bigotry too.
Order, Mr. Meyer.
Earlier, the MPs had taken evidence from the president of the Board of Deputies of British Jews. Questioned by Keith Vaz, Jonathan Arkosh said Mr. Livingstone's comments had been deliberately offensive.
You are quite certain that those are anti-Semitic remarks?
I'm absolutely certain that they were intended to offend, and they were anti-Semitic because whether or not he intended it, about which there may be speculation, what he said in trying to say that Jews were like Nazis is something that is plainly anti-Semitic, and I find it astonishing that he could have made those remarks and still stand by them.
Mr. Arkosh also told the committee that what he called a leftward tilt in the leadership of the Labour Party had emboldened some people to say things which previously they felt they couldn't say in polite society.
The election of the leader who is associated with the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, with Stop the War, with a very, very hostile position on Israel, very well known and well publicised, and someone who has thought it appropriate to meet here in the Democratic Mother of Parliaments with terrorist organisations, whose stated mission in life is to kill as many Christians and Jews as possible, has clearly sent the wrong sort of message to some people.
Jonathan Arkosh.
It's interesting that the Board of British Deputies, member of the British Deputies of Jews or whatever it was, referred to terrorist organisations that Ken Livingstone had met. What he means is Hezbollah and Hamas, which are both political movements. Hamas is the elected government of Palestine, although not recognised by Western powers, and Hezbollah is a member of the participating member of the democratic elected government of Lebanon.
Hang on, because maybe Jonathan Arkush was simply referring to the IRA, who were a terrorist organisation.
Well, no, because the IRA have also got an elected. You could say they were terrorists, and you could say they were also politicians. So this is underlying all of this. Is the whole question of whether the state of Israel should or should not be recognised. It is not anti-Semitic for Hamas or Ken Livingstone or me to say that we shouldn't recognise the state of Israel. The state of Israel was recognised in 1948 by the international community on a very straightforward basis.
By the US first, actually, yeah.
Yeah, the point is that they were given a border in 1948, much smaller than their current border, certainly not including the Golan Heights and the West Bank, and they were told that all Palestinians who'd been ethnically cleansed from within the border should be allowed to return to their homes, which is the same kind of deal that was done at Dayton over Yugoslavia. They haven't kept that deal. And at that point, you lose your right to be a recognised member of the United Nations. That's perfectly okay. We don't recognise Crimea as part of Russia. I think we should, but we don't. Why should Israel get a seat at the United Nations if they don't play by the rules?
Some would say that the land grabs in the 1960s and 70s in the Yom Kippur War and the Six-Day War have actually set a horrendous precedent and have shown that the UN cannot do its job.
Well, interestingly enough, when Ariel Sharon was Prime Minister in Israel, NATO declared war on Serbia and demanded that they disgorge Kosovo. There was no basis for this in international law because both the Russians and the Chinese refused to accept that Serbia should have to disgorge Kosovo. And Ariel Sharon did not support the NATO position. He didn't support the bombing of Serbia, and he didn't support the idea that Kosovo should be forced to independence by force, because he knew it would establish a precedent. If Kosovo Muslims can call in NATO and to fight the Serbs for them, then maybe it's about time NATO used all of its arsenal to make Israel get back behind that green line, just like Serbia had to. It's a perfectly straightforward proposition. The Israeli deaths are the same as Serbian deaths, the same as anybody's deaths, aren't they? Deaths are regrettable.
Yes, and in the Middle East eye, which I think is becoming really a very good way of getting news from the Middle East. It's MiddleEastEye.net is the website. These guys have pointed out something which I haven't seen anywhere in the mainstream press, an outcry from Arab states this week as Israel wins the United Nations Committee Chair for the first time, a decision to appoint two-state solution opponent Danny Dannan as chair of the UN Legal Committee has been heavily criticised by Palestinian representatives. They have said that this guy shouldn't basically be doing the job. It's the first time that Israel's chaired this committee in the UN's 71-year history.
Well, indeed, and the Saudi Arabians are chairing the Human Rights Committee. You couldn't make this up, could you? But, of course, the UN is like a medieval parliament. It's a kind of representative body, but in actual fact, it's stuffed with all sorts of power-crazed factions who are pursuing their various agendas.
I mean, this sort of appointment could actually spell the end for the credibility of that particular committee, because people just simply do not respect the Israeli ability to chair a justice committee. I mean, there's all sorts of questions,
well,
for example.
Well, there is a serious question.
Whether there is actually any justice over in Israel with this this case that's been going through the last few weeks about Israeli soldiers shooting dead a Palestinian when they were lying on the floor bleeding and kicking a knife over towards them to try and set them up as some sort of knife attacker when they weren't.
Well, indeed, and also the Mossad and the Israeli Defence Forces, along with our own brave boys, have been supporting the jihadi extremists inside Syria, who then, of course, turn up in Paris and Brussels and murder everybody, supposedly. It's all nonsense. I mean, President Erdogan of Turkey, our ally, he came along to the Charlie Hebdo bash, and one of the things he said to his own media was he suspected the Israelis had a hand in the Charlie Hebdo attack. Now, he's probably right about that. He may well be right about that, but he's our ally in Syria. So you can see what a mess this is all turning into, can't you?
To be fair to Jonathan Arkush, he's saying that Ken Livingstone was being really offensive, saying that Jews were like Nazis. I mean, that obviously is offensive,
isn't it? No, what he said was, and it's absolutely clear, what happened in 1933 when Hitler was elected was that the left-wing Jews and the Jews all over the world said, we want nothing to do with this Hitler government.
Well, there was a boycott, wasn't there?
They wanted a boycott on Germany.
They actually had an international boycott.
Yeah, we don't want anything to do with him. And when the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising took place in 1943, that wasn't organised by the Zionists, that was organised by Marek Edelman and the Jewish Socialist Bund. And Marek Edelman ultimately carried on living in Poland after the war and was an anti-Zionist. So to say that he's an anti-Semite, the commander of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, and I've seen some Zionists try to argue that with me when I've spoken at Speaker's Corner, say, you don't even know who he is and you don't understand what we're talking about here. The commander of the Warsaw Ghetto is a self-hating Jew, is he? Because he's not a Zionist. It's rubbish. Zionism is a political movement. It's got its good parts and its bad parts, but it's not the Jewish community.
It's a big difference.
It's a political movement within the Jewish community, and it doesn't have the right to absolute loyalty from all Jews. It just doesn't.
There's a big difference between saying Hitler supported Zionism because he'd made a deal with the Zionists to
get... Yes, he did a deal with them.
66,000 Jews out of Germany, to saying what Jonathan Arkush from the Board of Deputies said there, which is that Jews are like Nazis. It's not the same thing.
No, it's not the same thing, and what's happening is an attempt to smear... This is an orchestrated attempt by the Israeli embassy to enter into British politics in such a way that they can head off what's coming, which is the complete rejection of the current state of Israel's politics.
Can you say something about the UK-Israel lobby? I mean, how extensive is it?
Pretty extensive.
It's, I mean, it's massive in the US, isn't it?
Yes, it's massive in the US. It's pretty extensive here. And Lord Levy, for example, was a major fundraiser for Tony Blair. And he's made his position absolutely clear that, you know, if the Labour Party lurches any further to the left, as they would see it, on Palestine, then he's going to take his fundraising skills elsewhere. Well, ultimately, actually, you've got to understand that this is a matter of principle. We do support the Palestinians. We do support the Lebanese when they're attacked by the Israeli army. We do support the women, the people in Gaza when they're being massacred. And that's not because we're anti-Semitic, it's because we're anti-imperialists. We don't support our own government when it does things like that either. Now, we always oppose it.
I may be wrong, but I take the appointment of Danny Dannan, this Israeli guy, to the chair of the UN Judicial Committee as actually an indication that something might be in the offing this summer. And something else which has made me think something similar is the, or maybe, you know, a little bit later in the year, is the this announcement today that it looks like the Russians are going to be, there will be no rehabilitation for the Russians into the International Athletics Federation. That's just been, it was announced on the news this afternoon. It looks like the Russians will be excluded from, from the Olympics and tournaments like
that.
This makes it look as if the geopolitics is coming into sport. We've seen it, obviously, with FIFA as well. We've seen the news of these Russian guys, apparently Russian guys, attacking British fans as well. It looks like sport is a good indication, isn't it, of whether the geopolitics is going to get worse, because it looks like when geopolitics leaches into sport and stops fair games going on and fair matches happening, that does indicate maybe something else is in the offing. I wonder what.
Well, it is, but it's also about manipulating the masses, isn't it? I mean, it looks to me as if a hardcore of Russian hooligans who'd had some kind of military training initiated the battles with the English fans, who were actually being great ambassadors for our glorious country. But, of course, who would have an interest in doing that? Because the Russians, of course, are going to host the World Cup next year. So a load of nutcase right-wingers turning up and starting a fight with the Brits is not in the interest of the Russian Football Federation or of the Russian government. But they don't necessarily control everything that goes on in Russia any more than the British control everything that goes on in Britain. We're all being manipulated all the time. And things just happen as well. You know, emotions boil over. But there's an awful lot more manipulation than people realise.
Well, staying with sport, there's also whistleblower cyclist Dan Steele. Stevens has been complaining that his doctor has been complicit in doping, saying basically, look, this stuff is fine, and he's getting him to use it, offering it to him as a cyclist, as an amateur cyclist, I think Dan is, and then he reports this to the UK doping agency, and then rather than do some sort of spot check on the guy or on people who've been taking this drug, they just tweet, oh well, we're going to have a look at this, and they're not actually, it doesn't seem that there's a really serious attitude to doping here in Britain either.
No, and there's also, of course, there's a whole question of what goes on in terms of betting syndicates fixing tennis matches, football matches, etc.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of money involved in all of this, and always has been. You know, you don't want to see how sausages are made, you just want to eat them, don't you?
Okay, so back to Prime Minister's questions this week, and our local MP for Filton Bradley Stoke, Conservative Jack Lopresti, put a question to the Prime Minister about Brexit.
Jack Lopresti.
Yeah.
Mr. Speaker, I agree with the Prime Minister on Europe. When he said to the CBI on the 9th of November last year, and I quote, "Some people seem to say that really Britain couldn't survive, couldn't do okay outside the European Union. I don't think that is true. The argument isn't whether Britain could survive outside the EU. Of course it could. So if, as I hope, despite the panic-driven negativity from the Remain camp and Downing Street, the British people vote next week to become a free and independent nation again, will my right honourable friend join me in embracing the great optimism and opportunity for our country and our people that such a momentous decision would bring?
Say to my honourable friend, as I said at the CBI, of course Britain can survive outside the EU. No one is questioning that. The question is, how are we going to do best? How are we going to create the most jobs? How are we going to create the most investment? How are we going to have the most opportunities for our children? How are we going to wield the greatest power in the world? How are we going to get things done? And on all those issues, stronger, safer, better off, the arguments are on the Remain side.
Stronger, safer, better off, Martin. You're in line with that?
No, I mean, my actual view is that we're on the cusp of a major global financial crisis, and the whole discussion is in terms of if, all things being equal, we might be better off in or out of the EU. I tend to think that we'd be better off in, but the point is, in actual fact, that the Brexit debate and the vote next week could lead to a run on the banking system, not just in Britain, but globally. And if it doesn't happen because of Brexit, it's going to happen because of Grexit, it's going to happen because of the war with Russia, it's going to happen because of something else that's going to come along and kick it off. But if it does happen as a result of Brexit, that will be rather ironic, won't it?
Also, we'll be hearing in the second hour from American Rich Newland, who I met over at the Bilderberg, about his thoughts on a crisis. He's one that agrees with you, definitely a crisis in the offing. And let's go back to Prime Minister's questions now, and we hear from Jeremy Corbyn and David Cameron this week discussing this whole business of employment agencies advertising British jobs, but only advertising them abroad.
Last week, the Prime Minister gave a welcome commitment to the closing of the loophole in the posting of workers directive. We'll hold him to that. But we're concerned about the exploitation of migrant workers and the undercutting of wages in this country as a result of that. On that issue, will the Prime Minister today commit to the outlawing of the practice of agencies that only advertise abroad for jobs that are in reality jobs in this country?
First of all, he and I absolutely agree about the evils of modern slavery, and that is why this government passed the Modern Slavery Bill with all parties' support. We've doubled the fines that can be put on companies for exploiting labour in this way. We've actually strengthened the gangmasters' licensing authority, and they've commenced and carried out a number of prosecutions, including in the east of England where I was yesterday. And so we'll continue to take action on every level to make sure that people are paid the wages that they should be paid. And the protections are there on the minimum wage and now on the national living wage. I think all of those are vitally important, and we'll continue with all of those measures. I want people to get a fair day's pay for a fair day's work.
Jeremy Corbyn. Mr. Speaker, my question was about outlawing the practice of advertising by agencies only in other countries.
Yes, just pointing out at the end there, Jeremy Corbyn, that David Cameron didn't actually answer the question. It does rather invalidate this whole business of Prime Minister's questions, doesn't it, when the question actually doesn't get addressed. But anyway, about the wider point about advertising British jobs only abroad, so British people don't even know that they can apply for them.
Well, obviously wrong. Corbyn should be pushing at an open door there with the Prime Minister, but he didn't get much of a response.
No. I mean, it does make you wonder, though, doesn't it? If it's seen as just kind of one single market, there's no reason to stop people doing that. They can advertise a job wherever they want.
No, but you can make it clear that there are equal opportunities legislations and so on that make it clear that you've got to make it clear that anybody can apply, etc. Otherwise,
well, yes,
the way,
but if
the
they're not told,
that,
Martin, this is the point, isn't it? You only know that a job is vacant if it's advertised in a particular place.
What you can
if
do,
it's only advertised in Eastern Europe or somewhere like that, how on earth are you going to apply for it?
What you can do is you get a code of best practice.
Maybe you could go online.
You get a code of best practice in relation to something like this. Companies which do not comply with that code of best practice, including advertising jobs locally as well as internationally. I mean, for example, in Herefordshire, there's lots and lots of young people come over from Eastern Europe every summer to work on the soft fruit harvest. Used to be done by people from Wales back in the day. Now they don't want to do it or can't be bothered to do it or whatever.
There was actually a whole army of itinerant labour in this country.
Yeah, there was, yeah.
Largely travellers, gypsies, these sorts of people the point, Martin, is that those people have basically been banned, haven't they? We don't have travelling gypsy, that sort of population anymore.
The fact is that most people do not want to do those jobs, and the people who are coming in do.
Well, when I say banned, what's happened is that they've set up permanent sites and they've been told you've got to go to these permanent sites. There is a complete if you go around many of the roads in Somerset, Gloucestershire and Wiltshire, you'll find they've got massive verges. Those old road verges used to be for people to camp on the side of them.
That may be true, but I mean the fact is that if you want a best practice approach to employment practices, you've got to make every public contract absolutely clear. If you want a public contract to do anything, collect litter,
well, what
do
about
anything,
private firms? It's okay for them then, is it?
No, because those private firms, if say for example you are a private soft fruit producer, it may be that you're selling to the government, to, I don't know, the Department of the Environment.
Well, yeah, you're selling to Tesco's. What are you talking about?
No, but the point is you create all you can do. If you don't want to intervene directly, you could even make legislation. But there is already.
Well, that's what Jeremy Corbyn's
asking for.
Another aspect of that little exchange there was David Cameron talking about modern slavery, and this really annoys me because actually what we're doing is we're simply outsourcing it. There's been a whole scandal. I mean, this is just one example. Many others are around about Apple using child slave labour to build their computers. So you've got effectively, if you go and buy an Apple computer in a shop, it's quite possible that it's been built by slave labour.
So, in other words, the only way to stop this,
Martin, is really to stop anything being imported that slave labour has been involved in making.
Well, you could say that, and of course, what's happened is we've globalised our production chains in our lifetimes, Tony. And and that has actually been pushed for by successive British governments. There are lots and lots of economic refugees from Eastern Europe and Latin America because we've rammed Thatcherism down their throat, which puts their people out of work, it destroys their small farmers, and then their young people get on their bikes and look for work like Norman Tebbit told them to.
Let me just, run through,
upon
let
your
me just run through this Apple stuff because it is pretty shocking. There's an article in the Huffington Post, how the iPhone helps perpetuate modern day slavery. The Daily Mail revealed inside Apple's Chinese sweatshop factory where workers... Oh, I'm not sure. It's just conked out there, so I'm not quite sure what happens. It sounds pretty horrific. And then The Register, which is a tech magazine, Apple iPhone factory workers imprisoned in virtual slavery. Now, I mean, isn't that one of the problems with globalisation? Actually, what it really ends up with, and I suppose this is
race to the bottom
of the EU too. Yeah, it is. It's done. Down everything, a race to the bottom.
Well, what you've got to do is you've got to allow the democratic authorities in every country to be able to pursue...
What, in China?
The authorities, which need to be more democratic in China. But there's still a Chinese national interest, whether the government pursues it or not. What we've done since the 1970s, with the City of London cheering it on and British governments pushing it, is the capacity for countries in the developing world to pursue their own policies in their own interests. For example, protecting their infant industries, protecting their agriculture, protecting the whole question about patent law has been rigged in favour of the multinationals. Things like the North American Free Trade Agreement led to massive job losses in the agricultural sector in Mexico. And then, of course, these people get on their bikes to go to the United States to work as cleaners and janitors. And this is, we're coming to the end of the line. And if there is a crash, of course, that whole process will judder to a halt on one level. But on another level, everybody will be so desperate that it's not quite clear what will happen. And we've brought ourselves to this by the massive worship of the free market ideology, which collapsed when the banks collapsed, but won't lie down.
One of the things I came across over in Dresden was had a chat to a guy, just happened to meet him, who was a former director of the Bundesbank. And he was explaining how the private banks are now far more dominant than the national central banks, which are supposed to serve the public. So there's a kind of a hidden war been going on between private banking and central banks, government banks. And of course, it's the private banks and private businesses controlled by these banks that own all the infrastructure, the cash point infrastructure, that sort of thing.
It is, and of course it's been argued by Richard Murphy, among others on this show, that the infrastructure should be publicly owned, and then you could allow private banks to go bust,
is it
but
too
the infrastructure
late?
Remains...
Is it too late?
Well, it is too late on one level, because the stable door is open and the horse is gambling in the field.
People like the Brazilians and the Chinese and the Russians actually have all said, well, actually we're going to set up our own systems because we don't trust that. That's the sort of international system.
What's happened in
Swift payments and that
sort of
thing.
Recently, as we know, is that the Dilma Rousseff of the Partido dos Trabalhadores, the Workers' Party, has been pushed out by a legal coup. Orchestrated from the United States.
So that may be a reaction to their wish to be financially independent.
Indeed. There's no such thing as independence. Freedom ain't free.
And so you want to join the EU and the Euro as well?
No, I don't want to join the Euro. The Euro needs to be deconstructed a bit. Oscar Lafontaine, who's now a member of the Linkspartei in Germany, but was SPD, he's saying we should go back to the European exchange rate mechanism, where everybody has their own currency linked to the Euro, and that it's in fixed exchange rates, which can fluctuate within certain bands, but that gives flexibility to each country to pursue its own policy.
The Bank of England's been intervening this week, and also saying that Brexit would be bad for Britain economically, and also George Osborne says it's going to be 30 billion extra taxes if we don't vote to remain in the EU. The European Council's president, Donald Tusk, warned on Monday that Brexit could spell the destruction of Western political civilization.
Well, it all seems rather hysterical. The destruction of Western political civilization.
Some would say it would be a good thing.
Well, indeed, yes, that's what Gandhi was saying. What do you think of Western civilization? It would be a good idea. I think they're panicking. And the reason they're panicking is because, in actual fact, we're in the middle of a train crash, in the middle of a plane crash, in the middle of a ship sinking. And we don't really need any changes which are going to make things more unstable.
But I mean, you're saying basically give in to the banker suicide bombers in the room.
I'm going to vote to remain, and I expect Brexit to win. But when the banks collapse as a result of it, we're going to say, told you so.
Yep.
And we're going to stamp
all over
your head.
You may be right. Well, you can't do that, because the thing is, this has been brewing for
metaphorically.
Years.
Metaphorically.
This has been brewing for years. Anyway, back to Chris Chope at Prime Minister's Question on a similar topic.
Christopher Chope. Mr. Speaker, I'm looking forward to the British people giving me the opportunity to vote against the vindictive emergency budget. Will my right honourable friend explain that if the government is so strapped for cash, why is it still intent on spending £50 billion on HS2?
Yeah.
Prime Minister.
The point is that we will be strapped for cash if you believe the Institute for Fiscal Studies or the National Institute of Economic and Social Research, both impeccably independent, who say there'd be a hole in our public finances of between 20 and 40 billion. Now, you don't have to be an economic expert to see this. If the economy shrinks and you have fewer jobs and lower wages, you get less tax receipts. If you have less tax receipts, clearly you either have to make cuts, or you have to put up taxes, or you have to increase borrowing. It's a simple matter of mathematics. Now, there's an easy way to avoid getting into that situation, and that is to vote to stay in a reformed European Union next Thursday.
Well, Chris Chope mentions the £20 billion on HS2, but what about the £205 billion that they're spending on Trident renewal?
Well, that, you know, it's picking cherries, isn't it, that people want to talk about. I think Osborne's remark that he's going to cut £30 billion if we vote for Brexit was very ill-judged. There's no reason for him to cut, because you could just increase government borrowing. It's a Tory argument, a silly Tory argument. You don't have to cut. What's going to happen, the real danger, is that Brexit will create such uncertainty in the financial markets that Deutsche Bank will collapse and everybody's going to lose their jobs.
Okay,
not just some people.
Thanks, Martin. After the 6 o'clock news, the killings in Orlando and Batley, and also Bilderberg debrief.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.